Hey, Coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
Hey, Coach. I'm excited to announce a brand new way to access our resources to elevate your coaching monthly memberships. At Basketball Immersion, we know every coach's journey is unique, just like your player's skill sets. That's why we're dedicated to providing you with the flexibility you crave. Our new monthly access plan lets you get full access to all our videos and courses on a month-to-month basis, giving you the freedom to cancel or renew as needed. Whether you're just starting out or looking to add some fresh perspectives to your existing coaching repertoire, Basketball Immersion has the resources to help you reach your goals. Head over to basketballimmersion.com to take control of your coaching journey and unlock your full potential with Basketball Immersion.
Excited to welcome Kevin Malcarie to the Basketball Podcast. Kevin is an experienced sports and conditioning coach who has worked with sports teams, athletes, and professionals and clubs across three continents for over 30 years. He is the owner-operator of Design the Game Project, a platform that shares coaching insights and research to a progressive and learning-led audience. Design the Game promotes a constraint-led approach to motor learning and coaching. Kevin has studied on and off the field how humans learn to move and learn skills for over 20 years. Through the Design the Game brand, he has run several mini online courses around motor learning, decision-making in sports, and practice design. Kevin also runs TMC Performance, a sports and conditioning personal training business that caters to the overall health and lifestyle of his clients, from athletes to busy professionals, through a strength and conditioning for life and sport mindset and programming approach. Kevin has a strong educational background in coaching science with a BSc in strength and conditioning, a certificate in nutritional science and coaching, and a certificate in the neuroscience of decision making from Barcelona FC. Kevin takes an ecological approach to coaching and life in general, and has a deep interest in ecological dynamics and the constraints-led approach to coaching and motor learning. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Hi, Chris. Great to be on. Thanks for having me.
I've followed you for a while, the Design the Game Project and your Substack and the newsletter and all your social media shares, just tremendous stuff. And I'm really excited to have you on, and we'll get into those reasons why. But let's start right from the simple beginning, because I think coaches are still starting to grasp a lot of the things that are shared sometimes through this platform, social media, and yours. And let's start with the very basics, a constraint-led approach. What is it?
Okay, this constraint-led approach is an approach to sports coaching that has been born out of, and it's that comes from the combination of ecological dynamics, is ecological psychology plus dynamic systems theory put together. Okay, and it's broadly the belief. So there's a way of using constraints as a coach, and I think sometimes this is lost, and loads of people have been using constraints probably at some point all of their lives, as a player, as a coach, and in designing. And so everything you do in terms of designing a practice session in any sport, right, or even a one-on-one or anything that you're doing, it has a certain level of constraints on it. What is probably forgotten is that the individual constraints of ourselves and of everybody we interact with. So the dynamical systems theory and the constraints ideas of Newell and others is that we are constrained in every task we do by who we are. So I often joke with people like, why didn't I go to the NBA? Right. And I can talk about that in all three of the constraints that we look at in the triangle of constraints. There's the tasks. So throwing it into the basketball over 6'9" guys. Right. And then there's the environment, okay? So even if I was 6'8", and I know I actually am an SNC coach with the national champions here in Ireland, in basketball, Super League champions, which is actually right here in the town. And we've got 6'9" guys and really good basketballers, but they didn't go to the NBA. And we could ask that question, why didn't they? And the third part is the environment. And, okay, I'm 5'9". So that's the organismic constraint, my constraints, my genetics, and everybody's got that, okay? So the task, then my constraint of being that size is going to, I need to be an absolute, unbelievably skillful basketballer with unbelievable power and speed, your Bugsy Malone type. But there's other people now I can't think of. And even in those guys, when you go back and look at them, what was the Canadian guy, the really good Yeah, he was still 6'2" or something. You know what I mean? He wasn't small in the sense of... So they were my constraints. But even if I was that powerful athlete that could get around players, I didn't grow up in the right place. That's the environment. I grew up in Ireland where Gaelic football and hurling and soccer and rugby are the predominant sports. And I did a bit of boxing as well. And there'd be other smaller time sports around. Basketball was there, but it was very much a casual sport for me where I grew up, right? That environment, let's say the guys who grew up in America that have good genetics and are on the way to being 6'6", 6'8", whatever, and they get to play in the streets every day, their advantages in that sense, they're constrained by those things still. So I think sometimes constraints is mixed up as a negative, right? But we are constrained by various things, and they can be positive, negative, and in the middle. And they push us around, they create boundaries for us, largely subconsciously, of course. And the other environmental constraints might be at home. Dad's an asshole. So I spend all my time away and I get good at some sport because of that. Or he's really good and encouraging and I get good at soccer because I've grown up in the middle class part of England or Ireland. And he's bringing me there and he's encouraging. And then my mother's involvement. And did I grow up an only child in rural Ireland, which is a massive disadvantage for most sports, right? Or did I grow up in an urban area with loads of kids and I'm the middle child? So I have a younger sibling to look after. I have an older sibling to look up to and battle and fight and play against. And then his friends and playing up and playing down in these open environments in an urban estate, which is an advantage. Or is it? So there, that's the triumphant of constraints that we're all under for every task that we take part in, or that's the ecological way of looking at it.
So a constraints-led approach underpinned by ecological dynamics, we can manipulate within the constraints, the individual, the task, the environment. And to your point that you started with, most coaches, and this is one thing I share with coaches all the time, without knowing the literature, the research, you are using constraints in your coaching. Because, again, we're trying to shape very specific things. And in order to do that, most commonly coaches manipulate the task constraint. Yeah. Can you give us some examples of manipulating the task constraint within, say, something that we do? It doesn't have to be basketball specific.
Yeah. And just on that, I think some the discussions are getting better now, Chris, even on Twitter and places that can be fraught. Like the understanding conversations I've had with people who maybe come from the more traditional or cognitive science kind of looking at the world or sports or motor learning. The fact that we understand that instruction is a constraint, or actually lack of instruction is a constraint. And sometimes it was considered that constraints-led approach, or you design a game, you let them at it. If that's what we did, that might benefit some of them, but like of the kids we're coaching, let's say. But it actually might be negative for other kids who do need certain constraints put in for them, whether that's rules or whatever. So a typical constraint that I would use, say, to elicit a skill, if I could explain it like that, okay? So a common thing in Gaelic football at the moment, hybrid between Aussie rules and soccer, let's say, or soccer and rugby for people around the world who might be looking at this, is because of the flow of the last 10, 15 years of the culture of the game and the way tactically it's evolved, there's not a lot of kicking now. And sometimes it's got to a place where kicking could take place. And the fastest way to get down a field is to kick the ball. Now, there's an attractiveness to the way the game is played like that as well, that is a controversial subject. But I'm not talking about that per se. I'm talking about the efficiency of moving the ball. The ball moves faster than the man and all those kind of principles that we all know from sport. So how do I get players to kick the ball in a game? So let's say I have 20 guys training and we'll play 2/3 or 3/4 pitch and play 10v10. Okay. So the simplest constraint that I could put on that to elicit kicking is, right, let's say we play a transition game. You score on that goal, then you attack the other side. But after you've scored a goal or you've got into the end zone, whatever you want to play, you have 8 seconds to get a shot off at the other side. Okay. Now, over an 80 or 90 meter field, right, the pitch is probably about 125 meters normally, but let's say we've made it shorter because we've 10v10. it's very hard to get the ball in eight seconds to a shooting position by just running and hand passing. Okay. So what I have observed over the years, and it takes patience though, and this is the trick with some of this stuff, because it's usually not immediate. It usually looks chaotic. And there's usually even players giving out to you going, what the hell is this about? This is a stupid game. We can't do it in 8 seconds. And you got to try and work with them and hope that they figure it out themselves. But what does emerge after a while is they realize they have to space themselves differently to receive kick passes. And if you do get two kick passes in, you have a better chance of getting down into shooting position in 8 seconds. Now, I could have started that with 12 seconds, depending on the level of the team or how new the idea was or how good we actually were at it. That, without too much instruction, just the constraints of the game and my constraint of 8 seconds or 10 seconds or 12 seconds to take a shot means that something's going to happen, right? And my experience has shown me that's a way of getting them to space the pitch. So positionally, you can improve players and they will have to kick the ball, because otherwise you're just going to fail and it's going to be turned over and back up. And sure enough, over time, they figure it out.
They figure it out. That's the key part of all of this, is that they can figure it out, especially if we create the right environment and use the right constraints to be able to help shape their learning. And you mentioned illicit skill, and that's obviously one of the things that a lot of coaches misunderstand, is the difference between technique and skill. And that seems to be a little bit of a challenge. But does that matter? I don't get hung up in that in terms of when coaches think that way necessarily. But what does matter is what you said about eliciting skill. Skill is not the process of learning one thing and reproducing it over and over, to use your language from one of your tweets.
Yeah. So like, skill is in context, but when we play team sports, the technique of kicking the ball or passing the ball depends on how far away our players are. So if I narrow the field and still keep it 10v10, I'm creating traffic, but I might create a longer type kicking. We might get a hit up man or put our 6'5" guy up further and try and win a high ball. I'm going to change the type of kicking that goes on there. Okay. I could do that with a game, and we can do differential learning and stuff and do a bit lower level, like 1v1s, or just practice outside of the foot kicking, inside the foot kicking, punt kicking, all that kind of stuff. I'm not saying that you throw that out completely, particularly with younger kids who may not have explored anything. But what I would do, probably, which is non-traditional, is I would try and play a game first that is going to, and you're going to have to look at it as a coach. And this is where the coaching stuff comes in, is going, that's not happening. It's not working. So I'm going to have to try and, do I change the game we're playing, or do I introduce it in another way? And again, I'll go to other practices that will try and introduce skills. And I will actually sometimes even restrain a game, which is a bit of a different idea, where, for instance, let's say we're playing 6v6 or some kind of wave practice up and down, that to introduce or to create a concept or introduce a particular skill, I will say we cannot score till we hit a crossfield 30-meter kick. Okay. Or a high ball, or a backdoor cut, or we can't score till there's a cut run, or we can't score till A, B, C, D, right? And that might be a way of introducing it and then going back to the game and seeing if these things will happen. So the skill and technique thing is, technique is very contextual, and it's impossible, basically, it is impossible to recreate exactly a scenario where you will practice exactly the skills that you will be asked of in a game. Now, a lot of it to the outside world will look quite similar, but very often isn't. Because if you want to use a basketball, you've been used to playing a certain way. Maybe you go up a grade from Division 2, Division 1, and you're shooting three-pointers, and it's going quite well. Your percentages are high, whatever the norm is, and you're a little bit above that. But then you go play a big school, and everybody's 2 to 3 inches taller. So the constraints have changed immediately there. How do we do that?
Right.
And that's a new challenge live in the game. That's a new skill. And what I've grown up watching and being around a lot was, and particularly in the game of hurling, where we would practice a lot of unopposed shooting. The hurling probably mirrors basketball some way in the volume of shots taken in a game. Okay. And it's quite similar tactically. It's up and down a bit more. And we go out on a Sunday and have average or terrible percentages. And even as a player, I used to point out to coaches, like, we're not practicing this at all. And it's that fear of things not looking good in training and that fear of failure in training and not accepting the chaos, because it is chaotic. We all know when it comes to the big days, the games, and that the technique changes all the time. And there's a basic coordinative level on all techniques and skills. There is no problem with supporting or introducing elements that's going to help a player to stabilize themselves so that they can express themselves at a certain level.
So let me ask you then, from this perspective, and you can highlight what is wrong with this, because I think that's the challenge for coaches, to get beyond what they traditionally have done and what they traditionally have thought is technique development, skill development. I would say the last 10 practices that I have seen, when I have observed these practices, they have had 40 minutes to an hour of on-air, unopposed practice where they're working on something. Let's say it's a dribble move. I dribble towards nothing, and then I replicate this dribble move that the coach has told me to do, and then I go in and shoot a shot with no perception, no decision, void of any type of cues like distracting information or visual stimuli at all. Talk to us. What is wrong with that? Because this is what we see everywhere still in the basketball landscape.
Okay, the most obvious thing is, are you going to play against mannequins or air when it comes to the game? In real brass tack language, does it look like the game? Okay, there's nothing wrong with routines and patterns and stuff like that, just to get into the flow or to deliver concepts to a player or to warm up, right? Nothing wrong with that. But research has shown, in actual basketball as well, from memory, I'm doing this a little bit from Rob Gray stuff from memory now, but certainly volleyball and a few other sports, that repetitive practice actually makes competent players worse. Because at a certain level, like when you reach a certain level at any sport or pursuit of any sort, the variability and the challenge is what's going to bring your challenge point continually changes. Now, if you're a six-year-old out the back garden trying to get it into the hoop, that unopposed stuff is actually fine, because you're actually coordinating your body. You don't have the physical strength hardly to get it up first. And we retain that mentality in terms of coaching all the way through. But the challenge point is a key part, because the attunement to the information that we pick up, okay, we get better at attuning ourselves to various information so that we can then manipulate the ball, let's say, or make decisions to shoot or not shoot or pass or whatever based on the distance away from the player. We get better at what we practice. Okay, so if we do a lot of unopposed, isolated practices, that's what we'll get better at. Okay, and that will, for 5% of our development, as usually most of us pick up sport when somewhere between the ages 7 and 12 generally. That is certainly a help to us at that stage for coordinative reasons. But you're just going to top out, and you're not going to challenge the players, yourself, the individual, or your teammates to be better. Okay. So that's, the coach needs to think about it just purely as developing players. Can they do this? Okay. Is this in their locker already? Why are we doing it and repeat it again? What does the research tell us? That varied practice is better than block practice, unless you're an absolute novice. So I think even getting that out there, and some coaches go, okay, so there was some value to that. Yeah, coordinative value. And sometimes there's even a case to go back post-puberty or after a growth spurt, or you've changed levels. You've gone into a Division I team or whatever the case, or you've gone to a representative team for your own personal stability. But the way the ecological dynamics looks at learning skill is much more in a kind of spectrum, right? So a spectrum from exploration to stabilizing to exploiting. So we explore something when we're a child, like crawling around the ground, right? Or we find a ball or our parents' cup on the table. Like, we're exploring movement and what the hell is this? And we put our hand on a hot ring and we never do it again. But when we're moving and we're getting ourselves over to the couch and we crawl up, we find a bit of stabilization and then we fall down and we explore again. And at some stage, then we get on our 2 feet, I don't know, after age 18 months or 2 years or whatever, and we find we can stabilize and stand up without any help and then start walking. And then we can start running though. And that's a whole new experience. And then we can exploit things. Like we can run away from our parents because we think that's fun, right? And they have to chase us. So we've gone through an exploring, stabilization, and exploiting, right? Why would we think that any type of motor learning is any different to that? Humans are humans, okay? So I explore feeling the basketball, the Gaelic football, whatever. I often say, actually, one of the more difficult skills growing up in a way, and certainly one that's used in Gaelic football, is the solo. And so learning to solo the ball, it's part of the rules. You can only bounce it once. So this is a massive constraint in the game. And then you can, so basically soloing is kicking the ball to yourself underneath your hip, into your own hand, right? And you do it on the move. You can bounce and then you can solo, but you can solo as many times as you want. So it's an important skill, right? And at some stage, you're going to be exploring it. It's going to fall on the ground. You're going to kick it too high, kick it too low, not be able to do it. And then certain stabilization where you're in your back garden and you go, look, Dad, I can do this. If you have a very foresightful coach, parent, siblings, they'll try and get you to do it on your weak side as well, because this will help you differentiate you when you're older, right? But you're still stabilizing. And then you go and play the game, and let's say you've done a little bit more than the other kids. You can exploit that by running down the field and being able to solo, okay? Now, I often ask footballers, or I ask coaches who played football, that's my world largely, okay? That would be the predominant sport I coach. And I go, can you remember when you couldn't solo the ball? And nobody ever can. So we all forget that there was a learning phase to stuff that we think is second nature now, or fundamental, right? But we forget that we went through an exploring stage when the ball hit our knee instead of our toe and everything else in between. And then we stabilized when we went down to the games and we started playing with our mates, or was some of that in the street, or was some of that in the back garden? And that's the mix that it's harder to nail down. And it's the stuff that people forget. And we spoke about before we started the individualization. We're all selfish on some level or another, or think about how we did it and how I got here. And we listen to the great players. This is my story, but that's because they're being asked. And we all remember the stuff that we put into it, or the extra stuff. And very often that extra stuff is individual practice, because there isn't anybody else there to do it with us, or we are motivated to practice. And we feel that this separates us. Okay, and now there's other parts. There's the social stuff where individualization or individualism has grown across the Western world in particular. There is also the fallacies that have come out in popular books and misinterpreted research, like the 10,000 hours and stuff like that. And it's all come into the mix to say this stuff is really important. But what you're going back to the 5v0 practice in basketball, or the 1v0, whatever, the isolated practice, get them exploring again. So 1v1 for a kid who's, I don't know when the formal games start, but let's say 10 or 11, they've got some comfort both sides with the basketball and bounce it right out. They're considered at a basic skill level. Let's say they're in that stabilization phase. You want them to exploit that, take each other on 1v1. And they get pretty decent at that. And there's a bit of defending in it. But how are we going to get them to explore the next level? Okay. And that could be 1v2s. How are you going to be two guys or 2v2s? You got a teammate. So like you go back to that old system as the kids go through the ages, it's about me and my ball. Then it becomes about me and my friend and my ball. And then it becomes me and my friends. And we all know we're very selfish at 4, 5, and 6. And we keep the ball to ourselves. And then we start slowly sharing. But and like sports skills, and the Belgians and Germans have done a great job in soccer with this stuff, that they've stopped trying to human development. So they've integrated these human psychology things that we know about children, their selfishness, the times they start being creative, and so on and so forth. So I would appeal to coaches then of any sport, if they can do this at a basic level, let's challenge them, find a new challenge point, and get them exploring again and let them go through those phases.
Lots to unpack. The challenge point is such a fascinating one because I see in those same practices, the coaches get on the players about not being focused. But of course, they're not focused because they're not capable or they're not focused because it's difficult. They're not focused because it's actually too easy, right? And that's the part that coaches often miss. Well, we got to go harder. We got to go game speed and all this other stuff. The other thing I want you to unpack for us is, okay, so what's the solution? It's pretty simple in my mind and your mind because we do this all the time and we know it works. But coaches have a hard time reaching beyond what they traditionally have done, which is, oh no, you've got to learn this technique in isolation before we put it in a game situation. And I simply tell them, hey, listen, show them, sure, show them the in and out cross, but then have them go try it against a live defender and allow for them to figure out their own solution if the defender takes that away. And that's where obviously technique and skill come together, linked to an information source. So talk to us about solutions to this on-air, unopposed practice. And then how do we get coaches beyond thinking that is the way that we've got to do it? Because essentially I look at these practices and go, we spent 45 minutes on something that doesn't help the player or the team in the actual performance.
Okay. So the very simple low-hanging fruit that I would suggest, and I would say to a coach, don't turn your world upside down. We don't need you to be totally disc all the time either. Okay. And actually, and I'll get back to this now because I don't want to lose the train of thought. The players, particularly at adult level, it might be a little bit different to the States now, but adult sport is, and tell me if I'm wrong, but based on my experience of knowing Americans and having lived there, adult sport in Ireland is played at a way higher percentage of the population. Okay. Competitive structured leagues, people play closer to 40, I would suggest, in a more formal way, let's say, than it might be in America, where you were either pro college or then it was more pickup approach, right? Broadly. Okay.
By and large, youth sport is way too structured at too young an age, and they lose that chance to self-explore on their own because it's always structured.
So with coaches, though, what I would say is take it out. The best way to challenge, so whether that's certain types of skills or shooting or whatever, take it out even for a session and see what happens, right? And even take one thing out at a time. And what coaches will find after a while, I wouldn't even replace it. I would do the rest of your stuff. I hope there is some competitive, even if it's 5-on-5 or whatever it is. Take it out and see what happens, okay? Observe the players. Feedback then, what do you, and this is the challenge for a lot of people, for coaches, is to park not even your ego. With a lot of guys, it's not the ego is used a lot, and it is that case in some ways, but it's just what they're used to. Should I be asking the players, will I look weak if I ask the players what they like or what they don't? But get some feedback simply by asking, what practices do you enjoy? What part of practice do you like the most? Especially with kids, they just tell you.
I don't want you to lose your train of thought, but to that point, especially with younger coaches, I always ask them when I see them doing certain things like three-man weave or unopposed drills, I said, look, you're not that far removed from your playing days. Did you like any part of this in practice? Was this enjoyable for you? And it's why are you doing it? Because it didn't necessarily help you and you didn't enjoy it. My coach did it, so I'm doing it. And we got to get beyond that, right?
Exactly. And look, people do have to be brave. And you could go to the next level then after taking it out. Okay. All right. The world didn't fall apart. They still seem to play and we won the next game. So it's not that. But if there's stuff there that you feel we're not good at, okay, how about you? And basketball is really set up for this because I've observed a lot of basketball in recent years. And you can go from 1v0 to 1v1 to 2v2. Whether it's shooting or defensive setups or what, I would do this in tackling Gaelic football, which is an important element to that game. But whatever, like the three-man weave, for instance, as an act, what could we do to replace that? You know, without losing everything, you could just put in one defender.
Okay? I was going to say, the easiest thing to always do is just add one defender.
Yeah. So then you're varying, right? And there's new information for the players going out the court. Okay. The most likely thing is a layup, right? Most likely. He's going to make a commitment at some point, and it's up to the coach to motivate the players that this one player is important and they can defend hard. And this is something we can talk about maybe later, like you're constraining to afford, which is a massive part of the constraints-led approach. We are then constraining the attackers by putting in the one defender, okay? So if you really want to keep the weave part of it, right? Okay, cool. It might be a process for a coach to leave that behind. But what about 3v1 and two guys hit the sideline and come back in? So that's something I do a lot in Gaelic football. Very similar concept, though. By touching the sideline for a split second or two or three, it's 1v1. What's the defender going to do? He might just go for it. And then these guys have different, they have to come solve different problems, right? And it changes the angle of running. And I'm like, that change of angle of running is changing the technique and the skill, because you're literally changing your movement patterns, right? So your layup might be coming from a different angle closer to the baseline than it would have been. You just see how comfortable they get with that. And then the coaches get comfortable with it. You know what? That was a bit more dynamic there. Yeah. So I don't think throwing the baby out with the bathwater works that well. It's very rare that someone can just flip a switch. It possibly has happened. Some things have happened like that with me over the years, but it's very rare that you'll just change the way you coach like overnight. So I think dipping your toes into and replacing something you do all the time, right? Dan John is an S&C guy who has a great saying of, if it's important, do it every day, right? And I would take this approach with a team that might have weakness. If it's important, then we need to get better at it, whether it's defensive work or whatever. Let's work on it every session, right? But nothing ever looks the same though, right? So there's the variability. But pick one of your drills and see, can you design something that's more dynamic? And start with the drill, dynamic attempt number one, and wait for a week and do it again, okay? Because the coach does need to get comfortable with it. And then you really have to be willing to observe the players or listen to the players, because... And it doesn't matter. And this is one of the problems, I think, certainly in sport and in the macho, where I came from, Gaelic football, hurling in particular, be very macho in their own way, is what is fun. Okay, you're talking about 13, 14, 15-year-olds now when things are changing a lot and they're growing and they're getting that bit competitive. What is fun? And fun is challenge for a lot of people. Fun is laughing at the coach for other kids. Fun is just meeting your mates for other kids. And that's one of the keys to coaching, that it never ends, the challenge. Like, I work with a couple of clubs on athletic development work, and that's my main kind of bread and butter, let's say, is the S&C. And every team, there's a different challenge. And it never ends. And it's not necessarily negative stuff, but like, everybody's there for different reasons. And everybody gels in different ways. So the coach has got to find that and see, is there players responding to this? Is there players now responding to my more new dynamic three-man weave or shooting practice or whatever the case is? And then they go, I know what Kevin and Chris are talking about a little bit now, so maybe this isn't nonsense. And change is hard. So like, all change is hard for every one of us, no matter what. It doesn't happen overnight. And I know more. I'm coaching 30 years now. And the first things I did when I was coaching were the exact same things as that I did with my coach previous to that. The exact same drills.
We're not extremists, you and I, and we both believe in marrying these techniques to somewhat to get more comfortable with it, which I love. Let me share this, because one recommendation I gave to one of the coaches who invited me to observe was basically, again, look, I'm not anti you doing this on-air repetition because you're comfortable with it and you believe it helps the players. But what I'm going to tell you is, let's try it this way. Let's go one-on-one and then go one-on-0 and then go back to one-on-one. Or as you said, build it into 2-on-2, 3-on-3. So it gives them this opportunity to say, okay, let's try it ecologically first. And then you can always bring it back to the on-air unopposed and then put it back in the game. But too often, again, we build up and then throw them in the game. Instead of, let's play the game. Yeah. And then give them the things they need, maybe, that you feel they need, and then put them back in the game and follow this feedback with action. Is that a way to give them a little bit more comfort with this process?
100%. One of the words, and I was jotting down words, and you asked the original question, was switch it. So switch things around. I wasn't even thinking that specifically when I said switch it, but when I was thinking switch it, but start with the game. And a lot of people have gone for that now, because And even on the day, we might go with a plan, and such is the nature of learning, is particularly if you've introduced new stuff to a team, and this is even at adult or under 16, doesn't matter, and you play a game and you realize, geez, they got this a bit more than I expected, because often players come back after a break, and that could be from the Tuesday to the Friday, or it could be a break off season, and they seem to just know stuff better, and they seem to move, because if you've been working on it. So then you got to change it up and have a different kind of a challenge point, or bring in different constraints. One of the things I think to talk to coaches about in terms of change, though, is straight up I am promoting and suggesting you learn about constraints, because I think that makes the conversations easier. And I've moved a lot of my chats to that, in the sense that your drill is a constraint and you're lowering the variability of their practice. That's totally okay in a warm-up for a big game, because you just want rhythm, or you want routine, and that's what the players like, and you've got good at having them ready for the tip-in or whatever. But in terms of practice and getting better, we need to be challenged and the variable. So if you don't do that, you are constraining your players. And so I think that's the root of a lot of this, is that if a very basic level to deliver a basic understanding of what constraints are, that the people you work with are constrained by A, B, and C, right? And that could be, it's an hour driving to training, or so it's taken this guy 20 minutes to get going. Do I accept that? Possibly should, because that's the constraint of his life and he's coming to training. And then there's the different type of constraint when we practice design constraints, where we're designing practice. And we design a constraint like the one I talked about, 10v10 earlier, right? And what you'll see there is some complaining early, because it's a new practice, right? This is too hard. But some of the unexpected people will emerge because they're good kickers, okay? And they haven't been able to express themselves in the short hand-passing game that Gaelic football has become. So their value, and I'd probably fall into this category myself, wasn't amazing athletically, wasn't an up and down the field, but was clever and could kick pass at a high level, right? So I always wanted to express that. And that's just one example of many. So that variability and understanding constraints, sometimes it can be a constraint to be 6'11". Is that and that's both sides of the coin. That constraint could be you get, because you're that height, you always get marked in a certain way or defended in a certain way. It can also be a positive that you're able to shoot over anyone. So yeah, just that understanding, you're designing a practice and it's 1v0 or 5v0, whatever you're going to do, that's fine. Could be warm up and there's nothing wrong with that. Or you might be introducing a new play, okay? And you just want to get the concept there and some bit of comfort with that. And then just put in one defender, three defenders and five defenders. And each layer, you're adding variability to the movement and you're creating different constraints all the time. So learning about constraints. The other part, though, is more a psychosocial thing and a personal thing that I still get wrong at time to time, and I still find myself talking through games or little bits of instruction here and there. What we have to do is stand back and observe. We got to let them, and if we come in with a preconceived idea, even, and this happens as well with people who are very game-based. I'd see a lot of this in soccer sports, right? With the copy and paste culture, oh, I have a new game and I bring the game to training, but I don't actually sit back and observe it, okay? What is actually happening? Yeah, it's fun because it's a new practice and there's definitely going to be a challenge there. And there is probably, if you got a team that were doing a lot of isolated training in the past and you bring in a games-based approach and you just throw games at them, absolutely that will get them better at a very basic level, because the movements they're doing, the challenge of the game, and all that kind of stuff, they will get better. So that would say to me that if you were the basketball coaches that were very isolated, you're talking about your 30, 40 minutes of 1v0 or isolated practice or whatever, if they just played small set of games the whole time, I'd almost encourage, although I don't think it's the most optimum way to do it, I'd encourage just to throw games at it, right? Because that just variability of practice is going to get guys making better decisions, different decisions all the time. 4v3s, 5v4s, starting from this point, starting from that point, 14-second shot clocks, whatever type of practice you want to dive into, that variability is going to improve them.
Is there any research in support of this traditional approach? We mentioned early in learning, let's skip that, but they've got a comprehension of the game, they understand the tasks. Now, is there any support to us just doing all this on-air, unopposed, repetitive rote memorization practice?
Not really for me. There is research out there, but a lot of it for me would be on the lower level of what the scientific pyramid would consider strong research. A good shot of survivorship bias, because a lot of the research is based on interviews. And I don't know, again, going back to how people remember, we remember certain things and our memories aren't really that good off very often. So there's inherent biases in that. We look at success, and this is very often the research goes to how the best did it without considering all the environmental constraints or the survivorship bias or whatever way you want to look at it, that a coach got good players 1 year and he won. And then a team up way up a few divisions decided to hire him because he was successful with that team. And all of a sudden he's got better basketballers or footballers or whatever. So no, there isn't extensive research on actually having an all-out isolated approach.
So I'm going to throw a bunch of great lines from your newsletter, from your tweets, from different things. And I just want you to comment on them because I just love the way you phrased some of these things. It's not nonsense to practice. It's nonsense that volume of reps is key to development, especially unopposed repetitive shots practice. Variability and repetition without repetition is key to learning.
Okay. So again, the repetition without repetition is that variability. So we get good at attuning to the environment. And what that means, and that's a little bit ecological chatter now, but I get better at recognizing defenders approaching me when I come up with the ball, okay, where they're coming at. As I attune to that as I get older, because I played more games, from playing on the green against bigger kids all the way to playing games at representative level, I started tuning to what's coming. What we get better at is the attuning, right? So we start recognizing when we go through that exploration, stability, and exploiting stages of skill, we get really good at seeing what's coming in a way, right? So we can, our attention is not drawn to the inconsequential stuff. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Love it. And ecologically, we have enough evidence to suggest that learning is inseparable from doing in place.
Yeah. We learn in the game versus learning about the game. Our practice variability, I suppose this kind of goes back a little bit towards the research that we have versus the isolated. And that is quite limited in ways, to be honest, right? And needs a lot more repetition and exploration. But when people practice with variability in opposition, as opposed to the more traditional ways of practicing, the results are nearly always showing more positively towards the variable practice. Okay. So I think what's forgotten an awful lot is that when we grow up playing a sport, it's the games. We forget all the games we played where we learned in the actual environment, the competition, the game itself, right? There's all these adjoining stuff that we spend an awful lot of time talking about, which is important, right? Whether it's the coaching, the drills, or whether it's playing in the backyard with dad, or playing with kids out in the green, or playing on my own, or going to a different school, or playing multi-sport. Like, maybe the multi-sport stuff is like we get even better at attunement. Okay, we possibly get more flexible, maybe strength, maybe tougher if we play rugby, because the nature of that game, they're going to change us in various ways as we get older physically, but also in how we attune. So we're able to absorb hits, and it's really endless. But so one of the things that would best, and it's very hard for me to prove this now because there is no way of researching what I'm about to say, but in a few places I've gone and coached Gaelic football, there would have been far less structure. Okay. The training would have been way, they trained less and they weren't as formal about it. Okay. But they just played the game. And I don't think they actually had as much coaching interference. Okay. And these are counties surrounding me from where I am in Cork. Whereas in Cork, there was a lot more formal and structured. Okay. However, I would say that those people that I met in less traditional areas, and very often the reason there wasn't a lot put into it was because maybe hurling was the predominant sport and they only played football as a secondary sport. Those guys were way smarter footballers than the people I grew up with or the footballer I was. Okay. And the reason I think, and again, it's all I can say is I think that happened is that they learned in the game, right? So that's the doing. So they picked it up as they went. In place talks to environment as well, though. So the cultural aspects. So think about the way Brazil plays soccer versus the way England plays soccer. Okay, I'm sure you probably have basketball examples, West Coast, East Coast. I don't know if there's certain colleges.
Different amongst countries. And yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, sorry. The NBA versus the European. Totally. As someone that have a good interest in basketball, but as an outsider, I can see the difference now between the EuroLeague and the NBA. That's culture. Okay, so that's the doing in place as well, right? The Spanish way is, now we could go down all sorts of rabbit holes here, but the Serbians versus the Spanish, right? I've met guys who are Serbian, yep, Croatian, and Spanish. And the Serbs and Slovaks and those guys are drill merchants, drill, right? From what I can see, they need their 1,000 shots a week or a day or whatever the hell it was. Didn't mean they weren't good basketballers, though. And they were very good basketballers. Maybe did it inhibit some of them? I don't know. That's a wild question to try and answer for many reasons, but they still played a lot of street ball though. And it was culturally, it was there. Spain was different. They're very silky. They move very differently. The athletes, the Spanish players I've coached here in Ballincollig or observed in the Irish League, they just look different. It's like they're playing a different sport at times. And they have a totally different approach, but they still do quite a lot of isolated stuff, but they play a lot of sport in school. So soccer and other sports with it. So doing in the game and the place you are and what you're surrounded by is what I mean by doing in place. So we can't separate the culture. So the basketball in the streets of, say, New York, LA versus Spain versus Croatia, Serbia, they could all play a similar volume of street basketball, let's say, mm-hmm, for a comparison. But the cultural aspects around it, or maybe the other sports they play, are going to change how you perceive the game or how you play the game.
So just speaking on that, because you went down that rabbit hole, which I love, and we can get into history, and I encourage coaches to go read your blog a little bit, and you point out, obviously, world wars and how that defined how we teach physical education and all these different things, which are, again, affecting still the way we coach sport. And I could not agree more. I have a minor in history, so I love when we talk about history. But one of the easiest ways for coaches to understand, I feel, is that, look, a lot of us, I'm 50, I grew up with free play. I grew up with free play. Now there's no free play for kids. And we bemoan that as a fact that's a weakness in kids. But it's actually a weakness in how we structure sport for kids that they don't get this opportunity for free play. So I tell coaches all the time, you have to compensate for it at practice. Because you know what players can do now? They can go on TikTok, they can go on Instagram, and they can learn James Harden's move, because there's 100 trainers teaching you how to learn that on your own. And that's player-led development. But as a coach, you now need to create that free play situation that's not happening for them, because it's not happening on their own organically. It needs to happen within your practices. And that's a big part of history that you're trying to connect for us there, isn't it?
Yeah. We won't go down too far the military industrial complex type stuff, but a lot of the production line, very briefly, the stuff that I can reach out and understand and observe, and having spent time there as well. And so the north of England in soccer and rugby league in particular, they would have had a lot of play through the, like you're talking about, all the ways into the 80s and 90s. Right? We free played a lot. But what was happening in the, say, 50s and 60s, post-World War, is there's people working in middle management and in factories and in the industrial age as it developed. And there was the success of the World War in the Western world, in particular in the UK and America, that we can build engineering as the way forward, right? This is mathematics, engineering, that's what won the war. And then there was the production lines that came with that as well. And people were finding that if we organize people, we can do things a little bit easier, better, smoother, so on and so forth. That was brought by some of those people to coaching. Some of the famous football managers in England came from very social backgrounds, very working class backgrounds in the north of England. But the kids played a lot. So I think it worked really well. So they were playing street football and possibly cricket or rugby as well, right? And they were playing the up and down, like the older kids and all that kind of stuff. They were playing the streets, so the skills were different. The organizations seemed to work well. And it makes sense to me that by organizing your teams, you would improve. They were also starting to play in Europe and play against the Russian and Yugoslav military teams, who literally would bring good athletes, release them of some of their soldier responsibilities, and let them develop as soccer players. But it was still very militaristically driven, okay? So that was okay. But then as the probably 80s and 90s, and certainly the 2000s rolled around, kids played less, they're driven everywhere. We don't need to go down that. I think everybody accepts that on a certain level. It's like the emperor's there with no clothes, because the movement skills that we took for granted, but we're left with the industrial type approach to coaching, but not the regular. We have problems with school insurance in Ireland. There's kids not allowed running the school. I don't want to go too far down that route,
but basically you're saying,
worth talking about that though.
Yeah, but basically you're saying players were able to overcome the structure because they played unstructured. And nowadays players are not able to overcome the structure because there's no unstructured. And that's the challenge, is that when coaches bemoan all players don't know how to make decisions, they're not very creative. Obviously, it comes back to the environment that we've created for them, that they don't have these opportunities to be able to have these things be shaped or evolve. And that's part of it as well. So talk to us about...
Can I jump back to your... You started there and I had something in my mind about just for coaches and practice design, right? And the individuality, the James Harding idea, right? That the James Harding move or whatever that is.
Yep.
So I think a way of connecting with players, particularly younger players, they're seeing this TikTok generation, like... It's like the Belgians and Germans. Let's not fight child development at 6, 7, 8, 9.
Agreed.
Let's not fight TikTok either. Okay. How can we use that to our advantage? So, kids, what's the move you want to work on? Let this isolated practice be isolated. And let them share that 5, 10 minutes at the start. Let's do some moves, lads. And then we go into a game and how's the moves? Look, if you pull off one of those moves in our small sided game,
you get double points. Yeah. Can you now apply it? Yeah.
Yeah. And reward.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Reward it and say that works particularly well with younger people.
Can I clarify that for coaches that are listening? What you're saying though is that's their time to self-explore moves on their own and then try and apply them in the game. It's not me prescribing it as a coach. Do it exactly this way.
Yeah. And you can create kind of buddy systems or within the team. There might even be a bit of competitiveness. Kids talk, they'll share stuff, and they'll go away and look for... And there's a different kind of motivation might emerge from that, right? It doesn't mean it takes up all of your training session or anything like that, but you're connecting to the big shots. You're connecting to the NBA. That's an important part of it. The professional game, the highest level, people enjoy that. That's an inspirational side of any sport, and it's important for children. And you're connecting that to the practice and a little window of excitement and exploration for the children. And if you're still that coach who's still a little uncomfortable with moving away from the fundamentals that we need to hit 1,000 shots a week or whatever the things you have, that's fair enough. But just give a little bit and see what happens with that kind of stuff. So I just wanted to jump back to the James Harding idea.
I love it. Because, coach, it's a dream for me that my daughters, when they watch an NBA highlight or something with me and they say, oh, I want to go try that. And I say, absolutely, go try that. I'm not going to teach it to you. I want you to go try it and then see. And I'll connect this for you with something else I want you to talk about with this notion of perfect technique. I post a video of my 12-year-old daughter shooting, and I intentionally post misses and makes because I don't want people to have any perception that this, what I do, leads to perfection. It doesn't.
Yeah.
But immediately I will get coaches commenting on saying, oh, she needs to do this. She needs to do this. She needs to do this. And I'm like, mom, my response is all the time, you know what? Her shot feels great for her. It functions really well for her. And we get obsessed with form over function. So talk a little bit about this notion of perfect technique.
Okay, well, it's a wildly big subject in a way. Technique, ultimately, is the result that matters. Okay, we're not going to hit every shot, but are we getting it near the basket? Or
I could post she makes 10 in a row and somebody would still say she needs to do something differently.
Yeah, absolutely. But is she hitting 100% in the games? We all accept that's not going to happen. So perfect technique, why do you want perfect technique? Like, we just have to think about this logically and reverse back from, say, perfect technique. So when are we going to get the opportunity to be perfect? Like, we can go back to Jordan's videos. So it's very easy to talk about Michael Jordan. I could do it on YouTube in 10 minutes. I could pick three of his floaters, okay? That the famous shots where he's jumping from the free throw line kind of thing. And I guarantee his movement is different in every one of them. I guarantee where he releases the ball is different in every one of them. And all those little things about it. None of them are exactly the same. So we got to understand who people like that are as well. And what are we watching? What is perfect technique? What is perfect technique for a 6'1" versus 6'5" person? Are they the same? Can you show me three basketballers or Gaelic footballers who do the thing that you're talking about, practicing with kicking, shooting, dribbling, whatever, exactly the same? Is it exactly the same? Slow it down. And when you think about it, are you observant? And if you're honest with yourself, it's not. Right? We find our own solutions. Some people in basketball are very comfortable with playing the ball under their legs. Why is that, Chris? Like, why do you think that is? I'm asking you now.
Because it works for them. And it's such a great example because I say it all the time, like to counter a defender. So a defender recovers chest to chest and you now need to counter them. It's now me going, okay, I could use it between the legs. I could use a crossover. I could use it behind the back. And you know what? Every time I've taught it, coach, the individual player decides what one they like best, what their preference is. And it's never been all want to go between their legs.
Exactly. And I would go back another level to genetics and our constraints. I observe the guys here who seem to do it so fluidly, but they have amazing long legs, right? Their knee to hip ratio is absurd compared to me, let's say, or other guys that they're even playing with. And sometimes they're 6'5", and the guy standing beside them is 6'5", but they just have longer legs. And as they grew up, it was just easier to do it. We can be as brass tacks about it in physical biomechanics and our abilities. We're constrained by that, and both positively and negatively. Or the constraint makes things difficult. I shouldn't even say positively or negatively. The constraint is going to constrain us to it creates different affordances for us. So my height creates different affordances for me. So we could just go endless, and I can give a quick anecdote about myself. Was I was stocky, strong, pretty much as soon as I came out of puberty, and I boxed, and I always had to box taller guys. I was 2 or 3 kg always heavier than guys my own height, and so I learned to fight with the body and get in underneath. That if I stood back, I was in trouble. So that was so obviously I'm looking back in hindsight at that. I probably should have doubled down on that because that was my advantages were that if I got in close, it was hard for them to hit me. So that exists in every kind of sporting pursuit we take part in.
So you mentioned affordances a few times. So let's just cover that. The concept of limiting something to afford something is a foundation of this constraints-led approach. So talk about affordances, please.
Okay, so affordance is, according to Gibson, who's the originator of a lot of the ecological psychology research and study, and it's obviously grown over the years since then. He said he made up the word, which is something that's important, but he felt it was the best way of describing our opportunities to act and the environment. Let's say the basketball court and the team we're playing is probably the best way of putting it, will give us affordances to act. So if I come down the court with a basketball and I'm seeing 3-2, okay, that's telling me something. I can act in a certain, if I've never seen it before, I might try and play the way that I played against man to man. And that's why we get turned over, or we struggle to make it to the basket, or whatever the case is. In a game, every time we're playing the game, there's certain affordances allowed to us. Okay, so when we're creating practices, then we want to create a practice that's going to open up opportunities for players to make decisions. Okay, now we don't want to be exact about this, and this is where the coaching craft comes in after and time and patience, right? So if I have good defenders at a very basic level, okay, Gaelic football is an invasion sport played on a very big field, 15v15, right? A lot of the game still is 1v1 up to about 4v3, okay? Thereabouts. That's the way the game moves, right? So if I want my defenders to get better at a certain thing, I might play 4v3 practices where there's four defenders. So I'm constraining the attackers, okay, with their three players, to give an advantage to my four defenders. So we might get the look and feel of turning the ball over. Okay. If I'm worried about it, maybe I have to make it 5v3. Okay. If I think it's something that we're very weak at. Okay. So this talks a little bit to people when they say, oh, we need to build confidence with the isolated drills to give them the confidence before they go play the real game. And my answer to that is, what happens when they got the confidence from the drills and they get blown away by the 6'4" guy who kills them because they're too slow and their perception hasn't developed. But so I will practice 5v3s. Okay, they're starting to turn over the ball. It might be a bit too hard for the attackers then. We'll make it 5v4 or we'll make it 4v3 and we'll see what they do with that and layer that up. So they get affordances there, let's say in a 5v4. The attackers have the ball, we will get the opportunity to double up, okay? Because of that extra player, if the attacker makes any miss solo or slows the ball down, someone delays them in the practice, second man can come in. And then we're learning about turning the ball over, tackling, and using that extra man. And you can have a discussion about that. Why did you go in there? I saw he was isolated. I saw the mistake. Oh, there's a trigger. And I've created a practice that will create some opportunities to act. Okay? They may not take those opportunities, and we will often be surprised by what happens with the practices we design. I hope that on a basic level, does that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I want to connect this for coaches, and you've had three things, and I know it's not just three things, so let's qualify that. But like in coaches being able to make an impact right away in terms of constraint-led approach underpinned by ecological dynamics, even without understanding all that, kind of three recommendations stood out from your stuff. And that's like practice in context, which was representative practice. Two, allow and encourage failure or psychological safety. And then three, layer or peel back constrained to afford, which you just talked about. But those three very, I think, understandable things can lead to you running more effective practices, not just for the player in terms of their improvement or development, but also for their enjoyment and engagement as well. So talk maybe just real quickly about those three things as recommendations.
Yeah. So let's say the psychologically safe place, right? We spoke about layering up and the creating affordances there, right? Immediately, that's going to improve engagement and participation. And I'm not talking about participation purely in the membership point of view that the kid is coming to practice and coming to games and is a member of the club. I'm talking also at the next level that they're actually participating in the practice, in the group. They feel safe to do so, okay? Part of that is developed by allowing failure. Okay. But understanding failure is and why we need it, and that we got to learn as well that there's layers to us developing as players, and failure just isn't going out taking wild shots all the time either. And delivering as coaches to your part of a team, do you feel comfortable? Is this, I would say to players a lot of like weak sided playing Gaelic football, for instance, is this in your locker? Not quite at championship level. Okay. Would you be willing to practice it in a league game? Maybe not. Okay, let's practice it in training though. We're definitely not going to challenge or give out to you for missing shots at training off your weak side or kick passes over the sideline on your weak side or whatever. Or even in some cases, I really create blocks, maybe 6, 7, 8 minutes of certain practices where I really want them to go for stuff that might be a little bit outside their comfort zone. Really, it's very deliberately, failure is almost a must here. So I don't necessarily talk about it like that, but like I'm expecting a lot of messiness and failure. And then we'll go and we'll play something a small bit more comfortable and maybe a full game. Okay. So that will allow them to find their autonomy and voice as well. And I'm not just talking about vocalizing stuff. It's finding their voice, their movements, their comfort in a group. If we talk about self-determination theory and that, the motivation to come back, the motivation to practice, the motivation to get involved, that they feel autonomous, that they're part of the process, that they feel included, and they feel somewhere competent. Okay, and we got to kind of design to develop that competence as well, or to allow them to express some form of competence. And then in terms of the context, sorry, what was the context you were saying?
Practice in context, practice in context, which is representative practice.
Yeah, again, it goes back to we get better at what we practice, right?
And so if you want them to play better in the game, then you need to represent the game in your practices. Yeah.
And that might be just playing the game, right? And as we brushed over earlier, like you could start with the game of training and see if there's anything jumping out. We might work on that now. And you could still play the full game and put in constraints of some sort. It doesn't have to, and it depends on the time of the year and how many competitive games they're playing. Early in the season, which is totally against the way I was brought up or the way most practices seem to go. In fact, in Gaelic games, traditionally, you wouldn't see any ball for the first 4 to 6 weeks, which is, it's absurd, really, when you think about it. Whereas
it's absurd because you're removing the point of the game.
Yeah.
It's like when we do basketball drills and they're not trying to score or stop someone from scoring for a large part of the practice, you're literally removing the point of the game.
Yeah. And look, I'm an SSE coach, and I believe strongly in conditioning and strength and associative work that helps people be better athletes, which will help them be better players as well. But yeah, why are we there? Play the game. So even at the start of the season, I would play more open games, 10v10s or 9v9s, and just let it off. And then I might go, oh, we're a bit lackadaisical. I might put a time constraint on it. Or it's very much true. So some of the principles of play that I would lean into a lot, particularly from the tactical side, is we can play through a team, around a team, or over a team. We seem to be just running through all the time. So let's put on wingers, or maybe even a heavy constraint, like the ball has to hit the wing before you can score, or something like that. A little bit of observation like that, and then the representativeness, you can create slices of the game. So if you want to repeat something to get better at it, scoring goals, okay? If we're just running through on a goalkeeper, and taking shots, there's a little bit of a place for that, right? There can be a bit of fun, right? Remind me to tell you the anecdote about penalties, okay, at the end. But as I said earlier, the game of Gaelic football is 15v15, and it's played a lot somewhere between 1v1s to 4v3s, maybe 4v4s, right? If I create a lot of practices where we're going 5v4s, again, I'm affording the opportunity to the team of five. They have the ball, they attack. They should have a good chance of scoring a goal or getting a shot in. Okay? So that's representative, right? If I just go 1v1s, yeah, well, like I do 1v1s, then we can practice our step and go. We can practice. It's very physical. There's a conditioning element to it and all that kind of stuff. But representativeness, I want them going into a real goal with a real goalkeeper and that feel of a 3v4, 5v4, 6v4, or whatever the case may be. So that's in context as a kind of a slice of the game. Ultimately, the ultimate representativeness is competition. And then we just got to think about it back from that.
Love it. And do you want to go through your anecdote real quickly here?
Yeah. So last year playing championship quarterfinal. So what the team I was with, we, a lot of the time at the start of the training or just as I was arriving and stuff, they would be taking penalties, right? Messing. Wouldn't be the real goalie in the goal. Just guys messing around, taking wild shots. And anyway, we got to the quarterfinal, went to extra time, finished level at extra time, so went to penalties. And I've never seen so many hands go up. We had never practiced them, okay? And I have, we had, this is on video, I have videos of it. I'd love to send it to people if they want. We didn't get to the fifth penalty, I don't think, because we won it before that. But the four penalties were just amazing, perfect, unstoppable. And the casualness of the players did in the zone, clutch, whatever words you want to use. It was actually, we had to pick five out of seven or eight putting their hands up, which is not always the way it is, right? And no formal practice, none. But we nailed it. I have a belief that the very casual nature of the pre-game messing around they were doing, these are adults, school teachers, 30-year-olds, they were still having fun at training. I think that seeped into the penalty shootout because we were blessed to be at the penalty shootout stage. We had injuries. We'd come back from nearly being dead twice. We didn't play that particularly well. There was a lot of reasons not to be confident going into it. Yet it seemed once we got there, it all released. And it just really stuck at me that I don't know if that's why. I really don't. But it was just that we didn't formally practice the penalties. Maybe once or twice in the 2 years I was with them, we'd finish with a mess around, couple of penalties or whatever. But like nothing formal. We didn't have five penalty takers. We knew it was a possibility. So it was just an interesting thing that sometimes we can overcoach. It goes back to my talk about earlier that some of the rural areas that I've worked with teams that where hurling was predominantly stronger and football was a secondary sport, that they were actually ended up being smarter players.
I extrapolate that to free throw shooting and going, coaches that put an overemphasis on we got to make our free throws and we're going to practice free throws and we're going to always emphasize free throws actually ends up putting more pressure on the actual free throw than the reality of a free throw is a pretty easy thing. Go and shoot a free throw and develop your individual routine and your coping strategies and all that stuff. But when we overemphasize certain things, we actually draw more attention to it, which heightens the negative arousal effect of having to go do it. So I get it. Yeah. Like in a way, by not talking about it and not practicing it, you created this kind of psychological safety around it.
Yeah. No, to be honest, unintentional.
But aren't we brilliant when we unintentionally do things like that, though?
Yeah. And what you're talking about with the free throws, though, it's not, you can practice it. It's important to practice it and find your routine, actually, as you say. It's not that representative. Okay. Obviously, there's no defender. Right. It is a bit closer than, say, practicing three pointers with nobody there or floaters with nobody there. But it's closer to the real thing than, say, that open play. Right. But there's still nobody there. There is still no scenario where you have to hit two of your free throws to bring it to overtime or there's 0.5 of a second left or whatever. You know, there's all those psychological elements that are representative. So that ultimately, as coaches, we have to accept as well sometimes that there's a learning process. In competition, that representativeness, people have to experience that. And players who might be improving, and you see them, I see this a lot over the years, probably feel I was suffered a bit from it. You'd play well in training, get there, you'd get into play with the senior team or a higher level team or whatever. Things don't go well immediately and you're taken off. Everybody needs time to adapt to the speed of the game or the atmosphere or whatever the case is. We need attunement, which is, again, a very ecological word. But that representativeness, if we've never experienced it, we got to learn in the game at times. They're all ecological ideas, but the cup, the playoff, the championship, they're things we have to experience and practice as well. We have to practice that.
Which speaks back to what you talked about with the connecting that representativeness to your practices as much as possible. Because it just gives you more experiential opportunities in terms of that. And just awesome. Kevin, so much for us to digest, and I so appreciate you sharing with us and so many really great phrasing and examples, and really appreciate you. And coaches, I cannot encourage you enough to go, especially subscribe as a start to Kevin's newsletter, Design the Game Project, and follow him on social media And I'll post it all in the show notes and everything with that. But Kevin, thank you so much for sharing with us.
It was really cool to be on, Chris, and well done on creating the whole podcast and the whole project for yourself as well. I know, talking to the basketball people, that it's hugely popular, and you've done a great job for basketball at bringing in so many different types of ideas, and it's very progressive. So well done on that.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, and to give the Basketball Podcast and this week's guest a shout out on social media to show your support for us sharing the game. And to stay up to date on all things Basketball Immersion, subscribe to our newsletter at basketballimmersion.com/newsletter.